Hi, this is Zach chiming in before this episode of 22nd Century Leadership. Jib will introduce our guest, but I wanted to add a note at the outset about audio quality. This episode is a little rough with a lot of mic clipping going on. That said, this conversation between Jib and one of my personal heroes is too good not to share, so I hope the fuzz doesn't take away from the conversation too much. Anyway, enjoy. Our next guest, Rick Ridgway, and I first met on the flooding banks of the Katun River in the Altai region of Siberia in 1989. He was the field director for a documentary film of the first Soviet-American river expedition that I helped organize. Through the weeks of language barriers, flipped rafts, long swims, multi-day portages, and major challenges, I came to realize that he was smart, strong, hardworking, and always positive in the face of what looked to be insurmountable challenges. Since then, we've become lifelong friends in adventure and sustainability. Rick is now Patagonia's Vice President of Public Engagement, representing and promoting the company's core values with external stakeholders. In this role, he's one of Patagonia's key spokespersons throughout the world. During his 12-year tenure at the company, he has worked with teams to develop and launch environmental and sustainability initiatives within the company, including Freedom to Roam, The Footprint Chronicles, the Responsible Economy Campaign, and Warnwear. He also was founding chairman of the Sustainable Apparel Coalition, today the largest apparel, footwear, and home textile trade organization in the world. In addition, Rick is recognized as one of the world's foremost mountaineers. With three companions, he was the first American to summit K2, considered the hardest of the world's high-altitude mountains to climb. And he has done other significant climbs and explorations on all continents, including the first direct coast-to-coast traverse of Borneo and a traverse of Tibet's Changtang Plateau on a route never explored. His magazine articles have appeared in National Geographic and Harvard Business Review, and he is the author of 6 books. National Geographic honored him with its Lifetime Achievement Adventure Award. He serves on the board of Conservation Patagonica, the Turtle Conservancy, and is on the advisory boards of the World Wildlife Fund, Unilever USA, and the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation. Rick, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, Jib.
Yeah. So, as you know, we're pioneering this podcast with a theme based around leadership in the 22nd century, not the 21st century, but the 22nd century, built around Norwegian philosopher Arne Næss's somewhat infamous saying that he's an optimist in the 22nd century, maybe not so much for the 21st century. And, so we're going around trying to have some conversations with people that we here at Blue Sky think are leaders doing the things today that will lead us to a positive outcome in the 22nd century, and you're very high on that list. I'm excited to say so. In any case, thank you for being here. And so to that, let's start with what do you see happening, or what are you working on that gives you optimism towards creating a human nature relationship that will work for the long haul?
Well, Jib, you used that term long-term thinking a couple times in the introduction, and you used optimism, and that brought to mind a dinner I was having a few years ago with the great beat poet Gary Snyder, and we had drunk quite a bit of wine, and Gary was going on about how wine's about the only tool that really effectively gives him any sense of optimism. and then I said, well, Gary, you know, there's actually, if you think of it in the long term, there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic. I said, have you ever stopped to consider how at the end of each of the previous five extinction crisis, that the life forms that emerged on planet Earth after each die-off were more wondrous and complex than the life forms that preceded it. So that at every level, when nature cleans its slate, it seems to introduce onto the planet an even more wondrous array of life. And so if we humans are causing the sixth extinction crisis right now, then what's going to come after us is going to be even more wondrous than what we see and we're losing right now. So, I mean, isn't that great reason to be optimistic? And he laughed and we raised the glass to long-term thinking or viewpoints anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
But seriously, as you said, quoting Arne, that we'll maybe have to write off this century, but we still have a shot at the saving the day for the next one. And I'm not sure I agree with that, you know, because for the simple reason of that I think if we do continue on our path, if it is business as usual, as the popular saying goes, that we will have that extinction crisis that Gary and I were talking about. And it will take a few million years for new life forms to start to emerge. I mean, that is actually the future that we're heading towards right now if we don't do something about it. And consequently, there won't be any solutions in the 22nd century if we don't figure out what they are right now. And not only figure out what they are, but implement them, and implement them sufficiently that we reverse the current trajectory. And I might say on that topic, in my view anyway, the indicators of that trajectory are the indicators of the continued decline of the health of our planet. You know, to again bring up a popular phrase in business, those indicators of the planet's health are the KPIs that all of us ought to be using to judge and gauge whether our efforts, including our efforts in business, are making a sufficient difference or not. And if you use the indicators of the planet's health as your business's KPI, then you have to conclude that even a business like Patagonia is not doing nearly enough, because the greenhouse gas emissions are continuing, and the planet's temperature continues to rise, and the freshwater eutrophication of the planet continues to scale unsustainably. Deforestation, desertification, ocean acidification, you pick the indicator, and every one of them continues to go in the wrong direction. So we've got to do more. And the question in front of all of us is, you know, how much do we have to do, and what is that to really get things reversed? And that's the big conundrum, isn't it? That's the topic that we're here to talk about and address. But clearly, we're seeing that in this country, at any rate, we're not going to depend on government to do it. And that leaves civil society and business as the main agents of change. And representing business, you know, we recognize that here at Patagonia, we aren't doing nearly enough. We got to keep upping our game more and more to keep as much as we can offering new models of how to do business on planet Earth that could eventually turn those indicators of our planet's health around and send them in the right direction. And then when people ask me, well, you know, why, you know, what's the link to business? It's so obvious. Sometimes, you know, I get that from CEOs sometimes, and I know you do too. It is confounding that they don't get it. And it, at the highest and most simplistic level, the dots that I connect to those who may not in their own minds yet be doing that is just to say, listen, you know that without a healthy planet creating a healthy stream of resources to sustain your business, there's no way you can have a healthy business. If you don't have healthy, you know, if you don't have clean air and clean water, there's no way long term you're going to have a healthy business. And think of it this way. If there's not clean air and clean water, there's no way the planet can support healthy societies. And if you don't have healthy societies, how can you ever expect to have healthy markets? And that at a highest level, those are the dots that all business people need to be, surprisingly sometimes reminded to connect. So it is in business's fundamental interest to protect the health of the planet for those reasons. As our mentor David Brower said, there and at Patagonia, we quote on a daily basis that there is no business on a dead planet.
Yeah, so you bring up a number of good points there. So one is, as we started this conversation around the notion of short-term thinking versus long-term thinking, and it exists in a kind of our economic modeling. A dollar today is worth a lot more than a dollar, 100 years from now. And that abstraction, that belief system, drives a lot of our actions today, which leads me to the second piece, which is, there's a fundamental mindset challenge or a belief system challenge, it seems to me, that people have. And I know you and I both work with a lot of CEOs and a lot of business leaders who are trained in such a manner. These are good people. They want to do the right thing. They believe in long-term sustainability. They want to do these things, but they're almost like football players in that by the time you're running a large, particularly publicly traded company, you've been so groomed to look at a particular set of rather short-term measures as a yardstick of what you're supposed to do and accomplish, that it makes it almost impossible to make investments that are counter to that scorecard. And so, I just wonder, have you seen what kinds of things have you been doing at Patagonia to work with other companies? And even inside Patagonia, how is it you reconcile the business measures that tend to be, even in a privately traded company, relatively short term? My job is to deliver X number of items to Y number of consumers over this period of time. That logic with the logic of, the 22nd or 23rd century and designing for that.
Well, Patagonia is not immune to the internal tensions that are unavoidable between short-term needs and long-term goals and aspirations. We have them here, of course, as any business does. We, have our quarterly and our annual goals, and we have to keep this business healthy. If it's going to continue to be an example for other businesses, we understand that absolutely at a fundamental level, that nobody's going to pay any attention to us if we are not, as a business and as an example for how to do business, financially healthy, and not just a little bit, but a lot. And we are. Our balance sheet would be the envy of any executive in any board of directors, and I might say, financial gurus would look at our numbers and realize just how successful and financially strong we are. I think the only cohort that maybe wouldn't like our numbers is bankers, because we're sufficiently successful. We don't really need those guys. Now, that may sound like I'm bragging, but I'm not. It's meant to illustrate that our business model is producing really robust financial health. And the business model is long-term. The business model is long-term because it's based and inspired and built on a consideration of the long-term trends of the planet and how those trends might affect business. And we believe that when you look out on the horizon line long term from a business perspective, that we are inevitably increasingly going to have to conduct our businesses in an environment of contained or restricted resources, that it may be even inevitable that we will have to figure out how to do business in a economy that is potentially retracting because annual compounded growth and consumption is absolutely unsustainable long term, and that we also believe that when we look at these trends, there are no sustainability innovations and technologies that are out there, or that are even foreseeably visible right now, that even in aggregate are going to be sufficient to counter the consequences of annual compounded growth and the trends in consumption that we're seeing right now. So that if you believe those are the trends, what kind of business model can you develop that would be most resilient against those trends? And consequently, we built a business model that is at its fundamental committed to durability and quality of product, that we feel the best business model is one that delivers to our customers now and especially in the future, products that are going to really last a long time, because we think that increasingly people are going to align to fewer products and they're going to want ones that last a lot longer. We also believe that a business model for the future is most resilient when it mixes goods and services. So in that area of services, we're starting to see our partnerships with our customers to not only deliver the most durable products possible, but to help them keep those products in life for as long, in use for as long as possible, to repair them if they're broken, to put them in the hands of new owners if they're no longer using them, to recycle them using the best technologies available if they're truly worn out. Those kinds of services to our customers in combination with the most durable goods possible is a robust business model. And at the same time, we also feel that if we persuade our customers to not buy the stuff if they actually need it, then we're also positively addressing consumption and overconsumption, and that is a message that will appeal to more and more people. So as a business model, we think we're going to be in business for a long time. Now, what we don't know is that if people take us up on this request to, you know, not buy stuff you don't need, then overall global consumption might start to go down. And if we succeed, there's be a lot of others around us who may not. And what's that look like? Well, we don't know, because nobody knows. Nobody's got the answer to that one, at least not that I've heard about so far. But we do invite people to start thinking about that, because that's where we see things going long term. So again, we've got a business model built on that. Now, you asked before what, you know, how large multinational companies might look at this, and you know, what can they do? And of course, they're much more constrained than we are as a privately held company. And we recognize that. But still, I think companies like Unilever are really showing the way for how a large multinational can operate as sustainably as possible and still deliver the financial returns that the board needs to see in order to maintain the leadership in that company. And that's, you know, that's the combination that Paul Polman has pulled off so far.
And what are the, in your opinion, so since you used Unilever as an example, you know, what is it that gives them, in your opinion, the, you know, what are the reasons that it has a leadership stance in this area?
Well, it's a simple reason that in the 8 years that Polman's ran that company, that he's been the CEO of their global business, the stock value's doubled. It's just under 200%. I think it's like 195% or something. So everybody's happy. And at the same time, I think they've done an admirable job, you know, reducing their overall footprint, reducing it on a product level and a corporate level as well. they have also shown that in the portfolio mix of products, the ones that by their measurements, which are in the main valid in my opinion, that are the most sustainably produced, are the ones that are outperforming the ones that are less sustainably produced. They have about, I think they say that about a third of that portfolio now is what they consider sustainably produced. And that third is far and away outperforming everything else in their portfolio. So they are managing their business for sustainability, and they're delivering financial results. And that puts them in kind of a unique leadership position, in our view here, in the world of multinationals.
Yeah, no question. I mean, we've often, one of the arguments for all of this is long-term resiliency, in that if you can figure it out, if you can crack the code, how to make the right investments in reducing the footprint, you're in essence reducing the true costs associated with producing your products and services. And when you do that, you obviously build resilience for when there's change, radical fluctuations in commodity prices, when certain things change. If you're not reliant on these high true cost inputs on all levels, particularly relative to your competition, you're better off. But it's a tricky. I imagine Pullman's background as a CFO puts him in a solid position to really understand the nature of how to make sustainable investments in the near term for the long term.
It does, and it also gives him, I think, the ability to understand, where the challenges and problems are in a large multinational. But I must say too, it gives him perspective about where the larger societal problems reside, or the larger problems in business. And he thinks that the danger, or the problems that short-termism creates for national and global economies is driven in the main by the venture capitalists that come in with positions in companies that force short-term thinking and returns. He believes that small cohort of billionaires that are driving that are the group of people that are most to blame for putting the global economy at risk. I don't know if he's happy with me saying that, because he's told me that in private, but I suspect he'd be okay with me repeating what he's told me on that topic personally. And he's had to live through that with the buyout effort that Unilever had to endure earlier this year in 2017, that he succeeded very soundly in fighting off, with the back, of course, of his board of directors. And they really came to his defense, because he'd been delivering for them and for their obligations to the company as well. So it's an interesting story. There's so much for all of us to learn there. But, I've also, in my personal friendship with Paul and the time I've spent with him in the public arena, where sometimes we've gone out and given presentations together, he's told audiences that this long-term thinking, as you just said a minute ago, Jib, does create a resiliency in the business that is very valuable. And as an example, he's told other business leaders that just consider something like the trends around the pricing of carbon. And that if you look around the world and you see this trend, despite setbacks in some countries, including our own, in places like Australia, but you see that in the main, there's a trend towards policies that put a price on carbon, then if your organization has been managing its carbon intensity through its entire value chain, then when that carbon price comes online in one of your markets, then you are immediately at a competitive advantage to your to those who haven't been managing those intensities. And I heard them. I heard him tell an audience most recently, explain that to business leaders in Chile, where he and I were talking to some of them just a few months ago. And that was in advance of Chile introducing a carbon tax. So he got the ears of everybody because it was happening right in front of their own eyes in their own marketplace.
Right.
And I see that as a trend. And it's not just carbon, but it's the whole gamut, the whole basket of, of resources that we talked about at the beginning of this conversation that all businesses depend on. The degree to which you can manage your business for sustainability and consequently be managing your inputs of resources, those will all put you at a competitive advantage when the amount of the availability of those resources gets increasingly constrained in the future. Again, to underscore that point I made on that topic a minute ago.
Right. Well, kind of on the flip side of all this work with business, which, both you and I spend a lot of time. I just got back from Northern Argentina and the Ibarra National Park, where I had the privilege of kayaking out into a lake in the middle of the Estero that has basically no access. It's one of the biggest lakes I've ever seen that you can just drink the water out of. And that leads me to, note with great interest and happiness that you've been a long time advocate for conservation of wild nature. So on the flip side of working with businesses to reduce their footprint and beginning to inspire new points of view about consumption and what it means to be a human being in society today. On the other side, there's raw wild nature of which you've spent a lot of your time. I'm interested, what trends do you see in the world of conservation, and how is it relevant to long-term success for human beings?
Well, there is a new way of thinking about conservation that's emerging right now that I find very exciting. It's coming from some leading thinkers, for example, out of the Stockholm Resiliency Institute. There's another cohort of conservation biologists who are starting to rethink conservation in a more global context that is in turn in the context of arguably the biggest threat we have in front of us right now, which is climate change. So there's a new way to think about conservation in the context of global climate change. And it's a rather simple framework, which makes it, in my view, appealing as well. And it is a framework that essentially categorizes climate change causes and solutions into three categories that make it a little easier to think about where the solutions may reside. And those categories are the aggregate of human activity that is causing carbon release into the atmosphere now, and consequently the solutions that reside in that category around things like renewable energies and other technologies like that. And the second category of greenhouse gas problems and causes and solutions resides in agriculture and grazing and the degree to which we can come up with new ways of growing our food and the animals that provide us food, plants and animals, in ways that reverse the release of carbon from the ground into the air and actually reverse that and pull it out of the air and put it back into the ground. And then the third category of thinking about climate change is in conservation of wild areas. And there, this new way of thinking realizes the benefit of protected forests and grasslands to be carbon sinks themselves of global significance. So think about these three things together as the areas where we human beings can find solutions to climate change, and think that the third pillar of those solutions, and one that is of equal importance to the other two in the degree which could provide solutions, and you have a whole new way of thinking about the conservation of wild areas on the planet. And you can think about them just in terms of climate change, which is an interesting argument to be able to bring out and put on the table, because then the attendant benefit of addressing conservation through a climate change lens is at the same time you're going to be protecting all the wildlife and the biodiversity in those natural areas as you protect them as one as a part of a global basket of climate change solutions. So, you know, I'm really excited about that way of thinking. It works really well for us here at Patagonia because of the commitments to climate change solutions that we happen to be involved in and embracing and supporting here. So, of course, we, like many companies, like all companies committed to sustainability, we have our efforts to reduce our emissions, to make our products, as our mission says, causing no unnecessary harm, to make them as sustainable as possible. So that's our effort in that first basket of reducing emissions. Well, we're also, as you may know, and some of your listeners may know, you know, we're in the food business now. We have a startup called Patagonia Provisions. And all the products that we're making in that startup, which currently are just a line of fruit bars and some soup mixes and dried soups for hikers and climbers, and we have some bison jerky. We have we even have beer now. The beer is all these things are made from agricultural products that are created regeneratively that follow protocols that actually pull carbon out of the air and put it back in the ground. You know, in the case of our bison jerky, we're getting that bison from a ranch that is using what's called rotational grazing protocols to maximize soil health. And we've measured how much carbon is going into the soil on that ranch. And it's 4 tons per acre per year. Now, the ranch is, you know, 25,000 acres. So it's a tiny incremental bit of climate change solution. But what if that were to scale? Well, so we're working in that second category. And then, of course, as you know, and some of your listeners probably know too, in all of our 45-year history at this company, we've been committed to wildland conservation.
Right.
We're climbers and surfers. We're backcountry skiers. We are committed to using this company as an agent of conservation and wildland protection. So we've been we've been supporting NGOs supporting wildland conservation since we started this company. We still do, as you well know. We give 800 grants a year to environmental NGOs. So we operate in all three of those categories that are providing solutions to climate change. So this way of thinking about it is really an interesting way for us to think about our own business. Now, as I think about all three of those categories, Jim, and I think about the potential that they may have together to provide a solution to climate change, to provide ways that we human beings can go and go about our business and comport ourselves on this planet that will collectively reverse all those indicators that are declining that indicate the health of the planet, I think we can do this. And we need to get it done before the century is over. But as I start to think about it globally like that, in a big context like this, I start to think about the solutions that regenerative agriculture and grazing can provide. I think about whether we can align we human beings to realize that we maybe need to set half of this planet aside for our brethren wildlife in order to keep ourselves alive, because we need those forests and grasslands to pull carbon out of the air. As I think about all the collective efforts underway right now to collectively reduce our human footprint, our greenhouse gas emissions in this case, that when I look at it in overview, I start to get a little bit optimistic, even as an old fart at this point. And, you know, if I get a chance to have another dinner with Gary Snyder, maybe I'll tell him that, you know, we can even prevent the sixth extinction crisis and we don't have to wait 10 million years to see what kind of life forms come after us.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's a beautiful way of thinking about it. You know, I keep coming back to what is it about people that make this so much of a shift? You know, well, you know, Patagonia, as successful as you are, is still pretty small in the greater scheme of things. Your reach is limited, and we have a great number of people who are completely in a different, all over the world, completely in a different orientation. You know, everything from literally just wondering how they're going to make it through the day and get enough calories, all the way to, you know, billionaires who, you know, are living in an entire other reality, and everybody in between. And I just wonder, you know, it always comes back to me. There's so many good examples. I mean, you guys are exemplary, Patagonia, in your innovation, your willingness to take risks, your sharing of information, your reaching out to competitors and sharing of information. And yet I go, you know, at the end of the day, we don't have a sustainability problem. We have a mindset problem. We have a human nature orientation problem. And I just wonder, you know, how we're gonna, that's the knot hole, it seems to me. It's great you guys are doing what you're doing. I'm interested in one other topic in particular, that you know you were part of the forming small group of people who put together a thing which has become the Sustainable Apparel Coalition, and that is something that's truly operating at a multi-billion-dollar global industry-wide scale. And so maybe tell me a little bit about what that is and what's going on there that's interesting.
Well, it is scaled, and it's much more than that. It's in the trillions now. The aggregate turnover of the companies that have joined this effort, and it's a fascinating experiment. And I'll come back to that word experiment, because I use that word carefully and with great purpose. But we started this coalition, with your help, because you and your team were involved in supporting us to get this idea off the ground 10 years ago now, not quite. But the idea at its simplest was to bring together companies in the apparel and footwear sector to collectively create tools that would both broadly and deeply measure the footprints, the environmental footprint of companies in the industry, and also measure their commitments to improve social justice. So we brought everybody together to create these measurement tools. And then the theory was that if we got enough of the companies together, that the tools were effectively standardized. They were de facto standards, because we had enough people using them to make them instantly standardized. That if we got the group committed to figuring out how to make sure all the data inputs coming into the measurements were trustworthy, were verified. And then finally, if we got the group to commit to transparency of these measurements, of the data, of the information, that the theory was, the hypothesis, the experiment was, that we would then unleash drivers in the entire system that would incentivize key decision makers in the whole system, not just in the companies either, but the whole system. It would incentivize decision makers to make decisions that reduced environmental impact and increased social justice. That's the experiment that's going on right now. And those drivers, just so you and your audience understand what I'm talking about, the drivers are things like NGOs, let's say, that as a cohort, if you had companies that were measuring their environmental footprint and their social justice commitments, and the measurements were dependable and they were transparent, wouldn't those NGOs use those numbers to lean on and force the underperformers to perform better? If those measurements and numbers were available to governments, wouldn't governments be incentivized to create policies that require companies to improve their numbers over time? That if those numbers were available to fund managers, and if the most enlightened of those fund managers realized the linkage between companies that are managed for sustainability and performance, which is starting to become more apparent all the time, you know, wouldn't they influence the stock prices of the companies that have better numbers? And finally, if those numbers were available to all of us in our roles as consumers, and as consumers, we become increasingly aware of the consequences of our human activities on the planet. When Houston's facing the largest rainfall, perhaps even in recorded history, since rainfall's been recorded, that wouldn't we consumers, becoming increasingly concerned about these things, want to align ourselves with the companies that have the best numbers? Those are the drivers. And now here's where we are with this experiment. We've got the group together and we've scaled it. It now represents almost half of all the global apparel and footwear business on planet Earth. That's scale. The group has completed some of the tools, especially the environmental footprinting tools, through several generations now, to where they're very sophisticated on sophisticated platforms of delivery as well. The verification of the data coming into it is underway right now. And the whole group is committed to transparency on a roadmap that achieves full transparency by 2020. And for those of listening who might think that, you know, ask themselves, well, why do you have to wait that long? Well, just imagine the challenge of getting thousands and tens of thousands of factories through the supply chain to go public with the numbers when they don't have to. So that, I mention that just to illustrate the complexity of the challenge here. But we're getting there. We're getting there really quick. So I think we're only a year or two away of being in a position where we could show to the world what our baselines are as an industry globally. And then as we continue to measure ourselves, we'll be able, I hope, to show to the world how year over year we're reducing our environmental impact footprint, and we're increasing the social justice through our entire value chain. And then when we get to a point where we can show the world what that is, and we can show them specifically in numbers what that is, I mean down to how many tons of carbon we've been able to reduce, emissions we've been able to reduce, you know, how much water we've cleaned up, how much air we've cleaned up, quantified demonstrations of those reductions in footprint. When we can show the world that, then we can say, you know what, this experiment's worked. But I must say, we're getting close, and so far so good. And we're kind of keeping it under the radar. We're not blowing our own horn yet, because we're waiting to do that until we know that it succeeded. And then I think once we get to that point, this is going to be something that's going to get a lot of attention. And I also predict, upon success, it's going to start replicating in other sectors of consumer goods very, very quickly.
Wow. Well, a lot to be thankful for and hopeful to look for in all of this. And so how, one last question, and we're over time, but what the heck? You know, I, you and I have known each other a long time, and we've done a lot of expeditions to very wild places all over the world together over the years. And I'm just interested in how you see your own journey into being a leader in this broad space of sustainability. How does that relate to your background as somebody who loves the outdoors and has spent and continues to spend a lot of time in wild places?
Well, I've been one of the world's luckiest people to have had the chance to align my vocations with my avocations. It seems like all my life now. I don't take that for granted. I used to call myself an adventure capitalist because before I started working at Patagonia, I was able to make my living through books and filmmaking and photography of the expeditions I went on. I made everything work that way. And God, how lucky, or how fortunate to be able to have done that. But I must say, looking back at my own life and my own career, that these last 12 years that I've been at Patagonia, the first real job I've ever had, because I was always self-employed before here, that this has been, it is not a job. It's just it's a privilege. And it's a privilege every single day to come to work and to work for a company that isn't in business to enrich in its shareholders who still drive beat up old cars and fly coach, but to use the business as an agent, as a tool for environmental protection. So, God, I just have left, I've lived a charmed life where, again, my avocation, my personal passions, my personal values have aligned with my professional ones. When I bring up this topic to young people and I have a chance to try to, inspire them, it's to encourage them to always hold that up as the North Star, and to notice that, to understand that all of us in our lives have to make trade-offs between reality and ideal, but to know what that ideal is, to know what that North Star looks like, and to always strive for that alignment is what I think should be everyone's goals in their lives, and that those values that you're trying to align are the values of you doing whatever you can in your personal life to protect this one and only planet, to decrease we humans' footprint on our planet, our impact on the environment, and to increase through our activities, social justice for everyone.
Great. Well, Rick, thank you so much for all that you do and for being willing to share some of that with us today. And I look forward to seeing what's next.
And Jeb, just to leave it with one more thing that just came into my mind, and I learned this from you. For anyone listening, when you start to get into a funk over where the world's going, just remember what Jeb told me one time, that as predictors of our own futures, we human beings are very, very bad at that. Anything's possible out there on the horizon line as long as we all work together towards it.
Hi, Zach here. Just chiming in to remind you that the links for further reading about our guest and the articles referenced during the episode can be found on our website, bluesky.com, where of course you will remember that the E is in the wrong place. See you next time.